Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet the newly announced executive director of Gilcrease Museum. James Pepper Henry comes to Tulsa from the Heard Museum of American Indian Art and History in Phoenix, where he was also director. During his two-year tenure there, he increased membership by 150% and oversaw an exhibit USA Today called one of the must-see exhibits of 2014, Build Toy Brick Art at the Heard. And prior to that, he spent 6 years at the Anchorage Museum at Rasmussen Center in Alaska, where he oversaw a $110 million, 80,000-square-foot expansion. He's also been a former associate director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian and played a pivotal role in the launch of the museum on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Pepper Henry is a member of the Kaw Nation here in Oklahoma and affiliated with the Muscogee Creek Nation and will become the first Native American director of the museum since Thomas Gilcrease himself. He's expected to take over at the end of March here in Tulsa, and he joins us today from his offices at the Heard Museum in Phoenix. James Pepper Henry is my guest today. James Pepper Henry, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on being the new director of Gilcrease Museum.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad to have you today. What interests you in the position at Gilcrease? Because I know you only came to the Heard Museum a couple of years ago. What interests you in the post at Gilcrease?
Well, first of all, I've been in the museum field for a long time, nearly 30 years. I have roots in Oklahoma. My family's from Oklahoma, near Ponca City, Kaw City, which is about 11 miles east of Ponca City. My grandparents are from a little town called Washunga, which is now underwater after they built the dam up there and created Kaw Lake. And so throughout my life, I've spent some time on and off in Oklahoma, lived in Oklahoma at different times, and I've kind of grown up around the Gilcrease. Kaw City is only about an hour and a half from Tulsa, and I have relatives that live in the Tulsa area as well. And so Oklahoma, I consider Oklahoma home. Again, my tribe's in Oklahoma. I'm also of Muscogee Creek descent. And the Gilcrease is one of the great museums of Oklahoma, one of the great museums of the country, for that matter, and spent a lot of time at the Gilcrease as I was growing up. And what makes this special for me is that the museum was founded by Thomas Gilcrease, who is of Muscogee Creek descent, and I'm also of Muscogee Creek descent. So I'll be the first director of the Gilcrease Museum of Muscogee Creek descent, or of Native descent for that matter, since the founder.
Now, your museum experience includes several museums that not only combine art, but also history, ethnographic materials. And with Gilcrease, you have that plus the huge archival collections and the archaeological objects that are part of this collection. What are your thoughts on balancing the exhibition and the curatorial sharing of knowledge between these diverse collections? It's a different animal than strictly an art museum or strictly a history museum.
Well, that's what's exciting about the Gilcrease Museum. It's not a one-trick pony. It's not a one-genre museum. And I had a very similar experience in Alaska. I was the director and CEO of the Anchorage Museum at Rasmussen Center for 6 years. And they were a museum that was an art museum and it was a history museum. And while I was there, we actually absorbed a children's science center and we added science to the mission of the museum. So there is a lot of synergy between art and history. In fact, a lot of history is depicted through art. And with the Gilcrease, with its great collection of Western art, American Indian art, and American history, as well as the 300,000 objects of archaeological material, it can really tell a great story about America, about American history and the history of the West, through art and through history. And I always like to find the synergies between the two. So they don't have to be segregated necessarily. They can be integrated together to help tell a story.
A lot of times that tends to be segregated just because you have an art curatorial staff, you have maybe a collections and historical curator, you have a ethnographic curator, and getting them to work together is difficult. So it tends to be one or the other. How do you create that synergy between these different collections to tell one story in a variety of ways through a variety of objects?
Well, I think that's the key, is what is the story, and trying to tell that story, because a lot of times, especially in art museums, an object will be out on display. Many of these objects are taken out of their original context, especially especially American Indian items, they've been removed from their original cultural context, and people try to build a story around an object. And I think that what's important is the story, and so the story should be augmented with objects and other, and what you're talking about in this case is historical documents as well. So it really depends on the story you're trying to tell, and then bring in the materials and objects and resources that you need to tell that particular story. So if so getting away from object-focused exhibits, but having the objects help narrate or help tell that story.
Now, also with the Gilcrease, you have a really impressive collection of art. And that sort of complicates it, because I think a lot of visitors coming expecting to see the art first, and yet there's much more stories to be told in objects and archival material, ethnographic material that's a part of this museum.
Yeah, and I think the art obviously can help tell a broader story of the West. And I know Thomas Gilcrease, the type of artwork that he was interested in was mostly figurative and representational art. There's not a lot of abstract or absolute art in the Gilcrease collection, because the focus was on pictures or art that tells a story. So I think with the Gilcrease, with its fabulous collection of Western art and landscape art, that can help tell a broader story of the American West.
Now, there's also a perception that perhaps it's right, perhaps it's wrong, that Gilcrease has not been as effective as it could be over the years in alerting both not only a national audience in the art world in general, but the community to the depth and quality of its collection. Would you agree that there's a perception problem around Gilcrease? And if so, what do you do to change that?
Well, first of all, I'm here at the Heard Museum now, and the Heard had some very similar challenges where it had a national and international reputation, or has an international reputation, but local folks aren't familiar with the Heard Museum. It's probably the best kept secret or the best museum nobody's ever heard of locally.
And I've heard the same thing said about the Gilcrease, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the Gilcrease probably has a similar perception challenge within the community, and the Gilcrease it's off the beaten path. It's not on a major thoroughfare, so people have to kind of get off the highway to find the Gilcrease Museum, and that may be part of it. But there are things, obviously, you can do to attract a local audience, and what we focused on here at the Heard Museum, we understood that with 6 million people in the Phoenix area, we should have a lot more visitors than what we have. And so we looked at seasonality here in Phoenix when people come to the museum, with the high season and the low season, and we focused on the low season. And the low season here in Phoenix is in the summertime when it's 120 degrees. Nobody wants to go outside or do anything. People generally don't travel to Phoenix in the summertime. So we focus completely on a local audience, and to have more family-friendly and relevant programming in the summertime that would attract a local audience. And I think that's what the Gilcrease will have to focus on, is what's going to attract a local audience, what's going to get people to come to the Gilcrease. And the answer is a strong program schedule, a strong exhibition schedule. Most locals, I'm sure it's very similar to the Heard Museum, people probably say, well, I went on a field trip to the Gilcrease Museum in the fourth grade, and nothing's ever changed. I don't need to go back again. So I think one of the things that when I come aboard, we'll take a look at is the strength of the exhibition schedule and the program schedule, and look at things that are going to attract a local audience. And most local people want to see things that they don't normally get to see. And so that means bringing in some exciting traveling exhibits to the Gilcrease Museum, exhibits that people would have to go to Chicago or New York or San Francisco to see. We would focus on bringing some of those exhibits to Tulsa, Oklahoma.
You know, it's really interesting. I've been out to Gilcrease several times in the last 6 or 9 months. And right now, the two main art exhibits are really, if you want to call them, the greatest hits of the museum, if you will. It's this incredible American landscape show that kind of shows the history of the West through a variety of artists, as well as really a true greatest hit shows, the best pieces in the collection. And it's interesting, every time I go there, I hear people say, wow, I never knew they had this. And I mean, I think that's a tribute to the depth of the collection. But it's also gets back to that point you were talking about of, oh, I've been there, nothing's changed. It's important that the museum is constantly sort of moving things around so that the greatest hits are there, but there's always something new that's in that collection that hasn't seen the light of day in a while that might interest visitors.
Well, I think the key is to you know, entice people with something that's familiar and then introduce them to something that's unfamiliar. So I think some of the more familiar pieces in the collection are nice to have, but I think it's also a strategy to bring in some things that people aren't familiar with to expose them to new ideas and new thoughts. So that's something we definitely take a look at. Obviously, the Gilcrease has one of the great collections in the country, in the world for that matter, for what it represents. And you can't just tuck all those things away. You have to have them out on display. And I think it's great that the Gilcrease Museum is rotating the collection so people can see what's in the basement, you know, get those things out of the basement, get them out on display. But also, I think it's important to bring things into the Gilcrease from other museums and other sources to expose people to new ideas. But again, you know, I haven't landed on my feet there yet, so I think the first thing to do is become familiar with the staff and the constituents that support the Gilcrease Museum, and then take a look at developing a 3 or 4 year strategy and looking at what we can do to increase the relevancy and increase audiences at the Gilcrease Museum. And I don't have all the answers to that. I have some ideas and I have experience from other places that I've been, but I think it helps to understand the community and what the expectations of the community would be as a new director coming in, and then try to program the museum that meets the expectations or even exceed the expectations of our audiences.
My guest today is James Pepper Henry, the newly named executive director of the Gilcrease Museum. He's currently the director and CEO of the Heard Museum of American Indian Art and History in Phoenix. He'll be assuming his duties at the end of March at the Gilcrease. You were talking about assessing the strengths and assessing the staff. You've worked at a number of museums, the Smithsonian National Museum of the Indian, the Anchorage Museum at the Rasmussen Center, as well as the Heard. What's the process of learning about the strengths and the weaknesses of a museum when you come into a new location?
First of all, I can tell you right away the strength of the Gilcrease is its collection, has a wonderful collection. And also a strength of the Gilcrease is its staff, has a great staff. I think the challenges to take a look at with the Gilcrease, again, is getting people familiar with the Gilcrease Museum, not have it be the best-kept secret, and getting the word out about the Gilcrease. And that could be looking at a re-messaging campaign. It could be a rebranding campaign. Certainly marketing the Gilcrease will be very important. So all of those things we have to take into consideration. If that's the goal, if that's what the board and the governing body of the museum is interested in going in that direction, that will certainly work with the museum to and the constituents to make that happen, to increase the profile of the Gilcrease. But that's my perception from the outside looking in at the Gilcrease, is that, wow, this is a great museum. How come more people don't know about it, and how come more people aren't members, and how come more people aren't patronizing the Gilcrease Museum? So I think that will be a high priority, is how do we increase the profile of the Gilcrease Museum, because the pieces are in place. You've got a great collection, you've got a great staff, the bones of the place are in good shape, so the focus can be on audience development.
Now, we were talking about the community reputation. Among the art world, Gilcrease has, especially for people who are interested in Western American art, has an incredible reputation. How do you grow that beyond just the aficionado who really loves Western American art or American art to a more general art public?
I think it helps to introduce the museum with something that's familiar to get people exposed to what they might not be familiar with. So it may be bringing in something more popular, more of a name brand artist or genre to get people to come in the door, and then expose them to other forms of art or other genres of art. And to give you an example, here at the Heard Museum, you know, we're an American Indian art and culture museum, and we weren't getting a lot of local traffic to the Heard Museum. But there are a lot of young, creative, native artists in the community that were heavily influenced by pop culture. And so what we decided to do was put together an exhibition using the Lego building blocks. And we invited several young native artists and Latino artists to come in and design works, even traditional designs, but made out of Lego material. And then had some other Lego artists involved with the exhibition, and then but we introduced it as a Lego show, but But people came into the museum, and they were exposed to traditional art, but using non-traditional materials. And then, of course, were exposed to the rest of the museum, too. And that was very popular. Something that I've been working on here at the Heard Museum and also with the Gilcrease. The Gilcrease is part of a consortium of American Indian Art Museums. We're working on an exhibition where back in the 1920s, the modernists were influenced by ethnic art. I think you recall Picasso did a whole series of figures with African masks and so forth. Well, Matisse was heavily influenced by Yupik or Eskimo art, and especially masks. And back in the 1920s, there was a collection of what were called then Eskimo masks. We say Yupik and Inupiaq and Sukpiaq masks now. He was influenced by a collection of masks that was in a they were in a small museum in France that were collected by a young Frenchman back in the 1890s. And Matisse did a whole series of prints based on these Eskimo masks. And they've been kind of these prints have been kind of tucked away for the last 80-90 years, and they've just recently been rediscovered. And the masks that he was influenced by have recently been rediscovered. And so the idea would be to put an exhibition together of Matisse's material, the prints, along with the masks, and show some of the contemporary masks that are being made now up in that part of the world, and then to showcase parts of the collection that relate to that particular region. So using the hook of Matisse to get people to come into the museum, but then exposing them to native culture through something more popular or a more of a brand name like Matisse.
Mm. My guest today is James Pepper Henry, a newly named executive director of the Gilcrease Museum. He'll be coming to Tulsa at the end of March. He's currently the director of the Heard Museum of American Indian Art and History in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, Gilcrease, for the first time in a while, actually put together a complete show of their material, not for use in its own galleries, but for a show in Florence, Italy, and it showed off the Museum's American Indian collections. Is that a way to boost the brand name of the institution, not only locally, but nationally and internationally, by putting together shows from the Gilcrease collections and trying to travel them?
Absolutely. That show, from my understanding, was very successful, and I know the Gilcrease and other museums within this consortium that I mentioned have been talking about putting together kind of the best of American Indian material, culture, and art, and traveling that to other places around the world, including China and other parts in Asia. And, of course, Western Europe is very fascinated with American Indian culture. And I think that's a way to introduce other cultures to American Indian culture, but also to be able to kind of de-romanticize some of the perceptions that people have about American Indian culture by doing that, and showing the continuity of traditions by showing the historic items along with the contemporary items, and introducing people to contemporary Native art forms and artists. So, that exhibit that traveled to Italy was hugely successful, and I think there's a model there that can be emulated and even expanded upon and taken around the world.
Now, you mentioned this Western Indian, American Indian Art Consortium. Do you envision Gilcrease participating with a number of other institutions, whether it be American Indian art or maybe Western American art or just straight American art, the American art tradition, and combining resources with institutions to create some of these shows that attract attention, that will get people into the door, then a chance to see more of the Gilcrease collection?
Sure, absolutely. The Gilcrease is already loaning its collections to other institutions for exhibitions at those facilities and for other traveling shows. And
I was just at Crystal Bridges over the holidays, and there is the incredible Audubon wild turkey portrait that Gilcrease owns. It was the centerpiece of a Crystal Bridges exhibition on Audubon. So this material is important, and it does travel quite a bit.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, you have to rest items from time to time, but certainly there's great potential for the Gilcrease to get its name out through collaborations with other institutions. It's already doing that to a certain degree, but certainly I think the Gilcrease could be the producer of some of these traveling shows, working with other institutions, and that would certainly increase the profile of the Gilcrease.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to your tenure at Gilcrease. James Pepper Henry, thanks very much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
James Pepper Henry is the newly named executive director of Gilcrease Museum. He'll come to Tulsa at the end of March from his current position at the Heard Museum of American Indian Art and History in Phoenix, where he's also the CEO and director. More information at gilcrease.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
Of all the great gods, none were more handsome than the hunter Narcissus, and Narcissus knew it. The kind nymph Echo loved Narcissus with all she had, but he rebuffed her overtures and broke her heart, so much so Echo became a nothing, just a repeater of sounds. Narcissus' hard-heartedness outraged Nemesis, the goddess of revenge. So Nemesis lured Narcissus to a still shiny pond, where he fell madly in love with his own image reflecting up from the water. So engrossed in that reflection of his own self, Narcissus never left the spot and died. Since 1980, narcissism has been classified as a personality disorder in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, published by the American Psychiatric Association. This Bible of mental illness is a perpetual work in progress, updated from time to time, and is usually referred to by its initials, DSM, and the edition number referenced. The most current volume is the DSM-5. Narcissism, as a mental disorder, has its origins in the myth of Narcissus. According to the DSM-4, those with narcissistic personality disorder exhibit a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, a need for admiration, and a lack of empathy. While updating the most current edition of the DSM was in the works, many in the mental health field were shocked to learn narcissism would no longer be classified as a personality disorder. The revision committee believed the diagnosis lacked merit because everyone is narcissistic to some degree, and narcissism can be an effective coping mechanism. The recommendation to remove narcissism from the DSM-5 was controversial. Many mental health professionals objected because narcissism can become pathological, and it's a condition that can be successfully treated. If you can name something and successfully treat it, you've got a winner, they must have thought. Learned debate between the two opposing camps followed. Papers were exchanged, I'm sure, meetings held, compromises sought. All of that could have been avoided, I think, if the members of the revision committee that sought to eliminate narcissism as a mental health disorder had simply been brought to Tulsa, given rental cars, and required to spend a week driving in traffic here. Those of us who think we are good drivers usually aren't that great, and those of us who believe we are bad drivers typically aren't as bad as we imagine. All drivers make mistakes, of course, but these mistakes aren't what these mental health experts needed to experience. They needed to confront firsthand on our city streets the epidemic of desperately selfish driving maneuvers, also known in the spirit of this commentary as DSDM. When I talk about DSDM, I'm not talking about errors all of us make from time to time or bad driving habits we've acquired through the years. I'm talking about driving behavior that demonstrates a driver's complete lack of recognition that anyone else may be using the same streets and roads at the same time. Here are some common Tulsa DSDMs. Stopping without signaling in the middle of the street for no apparent reason. Clogging crowded intersections with illegal and poorly executed U-turns. Meandering across lanes to exchange texts on matters much less critical than avoiding head-on collisions or running someone off the road. Here's a favorite. Driving through red lights because the subject matter being discussed by cell phone is more important than the lives and safety of other drivers and pedestrians who just may enter the intersection because they have the right-of-way. And finally, one of the most common DSDMs, rapidly weaving in and out of crowded traffic, cutting off other drivers, avoiding collisions by inches and milliseconds to arrive in the Walmart parking lot 5 seconds faster. If you've driven in Tulsa, you can add to this list of desperately selfish driving maneuvers without much trouble. The number of DSDMs that could be included is practically without limit. Remember, what makes a driving behavior a DSDM, though, is the complete obliviousness of the driver to the presence and safety of other people. As far as I know, the committee which sought to eliminate narcissism as a personality disorder never came to Tulsa to spend a week driving around. In 2012, though, the competing mental health professionals and experts reached a compromise so that narcissistic personality disorder would remain a classified mental health condition in the DSM-5. The criteria for making the diagnosis now requires evidence of impairment in self and interpersonal functioning, characterized by a person's lack of empathy or being in relationships lacking in genuine interest for anyone else. Pathological traits of narcissistic personality disorder include feelings of entitlement, self-centeredness, attention-seeking, and firmly holding to the belief that one is superior to other people. The new definition of narcissism in the DSM-5 makes no reference to desperately selfish driving maneuvers. Maybe it should.
Mark Dara is a freelance writer and essayist, a local attorney, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.